So today I want to wrap up talking about kind of general field theory and intuitive field theory, and then switch gears a little bit and move on to supersymmetry. So supersymmetry will be our first explicit example of a kind of new physics beyond the standard model. But the last thing I wanted to talk about, having to do with just general field theory stuff, is a few more comments about effective field theory. So yesterday we looked at integrating out, within this theory, we looked at integrating out a heavy scalar and looking at the effective field theory we got for the fermion. And the main result was that the leading term in the fermion effective field theory at low energies compared to the mass of the scalar was a, from this interaction, was a 4-point fermion interaction. So that integrating out was just a tree level effect. But more generally, when you integrate out, the rules of the game are that you find, you compute some amplitude. You compute some amplitude for a physical process involving light particles. So in our case, we computed the amplitude for 2-to-2 scattering of fermions. And the general rule is you compute this in the full theory, and you design your effective Lagrangian at low energies such that if you compute the same quantity using the light fields, you get the same answer as the full theory. But you can think of building this up piece by piece in an expansion of momentum over the heavy mass. Now, we only did it at tree level, but you can also do it at loop level. And I want to make a few comments here about integrating stuff out at loop level, and specifically how this relates to naturalness and the idea of fine-tuning. So thinking back a few days, I spoke about how this Higgs mass was particularly sensitive to heavy new physics, whereas fermion masses are not. And we can see this explicitly in this theory, looking at two different limits. So the first limit I want to look at is, let's assume that the fermion mass, so here I've added an explicit fermion mass to the theory compared to what I had before. Suppose that this fermion mass is very big compared to the scalar mass. And that means that we expect our low energy theory to consist of the scalar without the fermions, assuming that my energies are much less than the mass of the heavy fermion. And I want to write an effective theory for only the scalar. So I can sit down and compute the effects of the fermion and the scalar. If I look at this, it turns out that there's no tree level effect of the fermion on the scalar, but there are loop level effects. So one thing that comes up, for example, is if I looked at this interaction, and if I was to integrate out the fermion, I'd have diagrams like this. And in my effective theory, where I don't have the fermion, these diagrams don't appear. So I want to make sure that this effect is included in the low energy theory. But this effect in the low energy theory has the form of just a quartic interaction phi to the fourth. And it turns out that we already have a phi to the fourth interaction here already. And the way to accommodate that in the low energy theory is that my low energy theory, I'm going to have a different value of lambda compared to what I have in the high energy theory. So in other words, I want to make sure that in my low energy theory, if I compute the relevant set of loops for, let's say I compute the one loop corrections to the 4-point vertex, and the low energy theory, so this thing is going to go like lambda. This thing is going to go like lambda squared log of some cutoff. And I go and renormalize that, and I'm fine with it. But I want these corrections to match up to what happens in the full theory as I go towards a boundary. So in this full theory, at one loop, I have a new contribution that doesn't appear in the low energy theory. So what I have to make sure of is I'm going to write lambda low as the value of lambda, the low energy theory. And I'm just going to write lambda here as a value of the lambda in the high energy theory. So here I have my, let's say, lambda high. And this thing is going to go lambda high squared log lambda. And this piece, it turns out, goes like y to the fourth log lambda. So one thing I get when I match at loop level between the low energy theory and the high energy theory is a shift in the effective couplings. So I need to shift my effective value of lambda in the low energy theory such that this reproduces this. Another thing I can see, though, is suppose I try to start off with a Lagrangian without a four-point vertex. One would be generated by loops through these fermion loops. And those are roughly equivalent statements. So one thing you get when you integrate stuff out at loop level is even though the form of the coupling might be the same in the effective Lagrangian as the original Lagrangian, its actual value can change. So in particular, my low energy effective Lagrangian is going to have the form 1 half del phi squared. And then in principle, I can have non-renormalizable terms suppressed by the heavy fermion mass. But this is the renormalizable piece. And here I have some lambda low that's not necessarily the same as the lambda I had in the full theory. So this lambda is what I'm writing as lambda high here. So this is for the four-point vertex and the effective interaction. But I also get a similar correction to the effective mass parameter in the low energy theory compared to what I would write down initially here. So let's take a look at that. And the way to take a look at that is in the high energy theory, we compute the two-point function for the mass operator corresponding to the phi squared operator. So this is like lambda 2, but where the 2 means 2 powers of phi. And this thing, as a function of momentum, if I write it out and I compute the fermion loops, well, I'm going to have the this is the one loop correction. And the one loop correction I get from fermions has the following form. So it looks like this. And and then in principle, I'm going to have a counter term in the usual way. And if I focus on the piece that doesn't depend on momentum explicitly, that identifies the mass correction, the form of this looks like so just very schematically, the full thing is going to be proportional to y squared. I'm going to have a log divergent piece. I'm going to have a piece that goes like so the form of the three terms that I get. This kind of term. The form of the three terms I get. Looks like this. I have a piece that's quadratically divergent, I have a piece that's log divergent, and then I have a piece that turns out to be proportional to the fermion mass squared. So I can use my counter terms to get rid of this and this, but I'm still left with some, in principle, depending on how I choose my counter terms, I'm still typically left with a remainder. And this remainder is what I identify. I'll put a 4 pi squared, loops usually give you 4 pi squareds. This remainder is what I identify as a correction or natural correction of the heavy state when I integrate it out to the mass of the light state. And after I go through the renormalization procedure and I look at what's left over, what I find at the end of the day is that the change in my effective mass parameter, which is essentially the value of m squared I'd have in my initial high energy theory versus the value I find in my low energy theory goes something like y squared over 4 pi squared, m squared log p squared over m squared. So this is the finite remainder that's left over by integrating out the heavy fermion state. And what I see is that if I wanted to take the limit of m being much, much bigger than m, I have something of a problem. And that problem is that I get a big mass correction from integrating of the heavy state to the mass of the light scalar state because I have this quadratic dependence here. Now, this correction doesn't have to be too big, provided the coupling here is small. But if the coupling here is not small, this is not that much suppression. And this is a big correction to the phi mass. So there are different ways of thinking about this. In principle, what I've done here has been a bit sneaky. So I've chosen my counter term such that I basically only cancel off the divergent pieces here. In principle, I can choose my counter terms in a different way. They also cancel off finite pieces. But the problem, and this is where the idea of naturalness comes in, is that the typical size after renormalization of the correction to the mass is this. And because this is the natural size, this is what you would naively expect. If the value of the scalar mass in the low energy theory is much smaller than this, this looks very weird. So the point is that there's a typical size of things. And if you want to make your scalar much lighter than that, for some reason it has to change from the typical size. So this is the idea of something looking funny. It's like having the balanced chalk on, or I should say the balanced sharpened pencil on the surface. You walk into the room, you see the pencil balancing. Maybe it's just balancing because somebody put it there very, very carefully. But when you see something like that, your expectation is there's something holding up. Maybe there's some very thin, like fishing line holding it up, or maybe somebody super glued it to the table. But your first expectation isn't that somebody balanced it very carefully and it just happens to be sitting there. So this seems to be the situation for scalars that are much lighter than other stuff in the theory that couples to them. And this is the issue that comes up for the Higgs, because the Higgs, as far as we know in the standard model, is a fundamental scalar. And we don't understand why that's the case. So yes.
For small momentum, the correction is negative.
Okay. So actually, yeah. Maybe just forget the log. So the log can be reabsorbed in defining a running mass.
Okay.
So let's not worry about the log. Also, is just schematic. Morally, this is the correction. And there are also non-log pieces that come up. Okay. But in any case, you generally find a big correction to scalar masses from other stuff. But the point is that this only applies to scalars. If I was to do it for fermions, remember that fermions have a chiral protection. So if I try to do the opposite limit, where m is much, much less than m, and I computed the correction to the psi bar psi operator, what I would find is something that looks like a divergent piece that I get rid of my counter terms, plus y squared over 4 pi squared, and some log. Okay, so in the same way as before, don't worry too much about the log. But the point is here, this correction to the fermion mass is proportional to the fermion mass. So now this is not a large parametric correction compared to what I started with. And the thing that's enforcing this is the chiral symmetry of the fermion. Or put another way, our Lagrangian has an enhanced symmetry in the limit of m goes to 0. And I can keep track of the breaking of the symmetry with m going to minus m. And since this thing is odd under that chiral symmetry rotation, this thing should be odd too. And that fixes this thing to be proportional to the fermion mass. So the upshot of this is that fermions don't have this big sensitivity to heavy states that the scalars do. Yes?
So the argument about sensitivity there was that looking at that term, you expect to have a big correction, but that you won't see it. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. So if I compute the size of the correction to the mass from integrating out the heavy thing, this is its natural size.
Right.
So in principle, I could also set this correction to zero by choosing my counter term in a sneaky way. But the point is that's a sneaky thing to do, in that this is the natural size of the correction to the mass once I get rid of the infinite pieces.
Right.
Another way of thinking about this is the same thing. This is roughly equivalent. Is that here I have a quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. And in this case, the cutoff represents new physics beyond what's in this theory that I haven't specified. And I see that my scalar mass is sensitive to that unspecified new physics. But even if I say, okay, let's not worry about that unspecified new physics, let's just get rid of it with counter terms, I can still look at the remaining finite correction from the stuff that was in my theory. And the remaining finite correction from the stuff that was in my theory goes like the mass squared of that heavy fermion.
But that argument about the fine-tuning, was it that you don't observe this correction, or was it that we can't explain why this arises in the first place?
Yeah, so the thing you see at the end of the day is the physical mass of the particle. You don't see the individual corrections. You just see them all added up to give the physical mass of the particle. So what we see in the case of the Higgs, assuming there's some heavier stuff, or what we would see in this theory with little m much, much smaller than big M, is a very light scalar mass. And so that would fix the physical value of the mass. But the thing is that the physical value of the mass is getting corrections that seem to be much, much bigger than it. So it looks like I'd have some big loop correction, and then I'd have to cancel that off very carefully against some counterterm correction, such that I got just some very small remainder. And I haven't drawn this as scale, or you can think of this as being on a log scale. But in the case of the standard model, if I try to extrapolate it up to, let's say, the Planck scale, I have a problem of this sort, where the height of these things are Planck scale, and the size of this is weak scale. So this could just be an accident. Maybe somehow the underlying parameters conspire in such a way to give me a small final value, but this looks really weird, because the natural size of the corrections are these big things.
So but does this mean that the physical mass that you observe is dependent on your choice of counter term?
No, so the counter term just specifies the relation between the normalized parameters in your Lagrangian and the physical parameters. So with the counter term, you get rid of the explicit dependence on the cutoff. But depending on how you choose your counter term, this specifies how your normalized parameters in your Lagrangian, that are now all formally finite, relate to physical observables. So yeah. So in principle, what I could have is a big renormalized parameter, of course, and a big counter term, such that everything conspires to give me a very small physical mass. But the point is that this is not what we expect. When you see two huge things canceling off to give you some little thing, it could be an accident. But our intuition is that stuff happens for a reason, and we want to understand, and we expect that there is a reason behind it. So this is a so-called naturalness problem, and this is what motivates a lot of theories beyond the standard model, explaining this apparent quantum sensitivity of scalars to heavy states.
May I ask a question? Like, when I do the renormalization, like here the singular term contains m squared times log of like lambda, and you said if I cleverly introduce some counter term, I can actually cancel out the m squared of log of lambda exactly, but I mean, you say log was schematic, but if log has some momentum dependence, like I think I cannot just add mere constant to the counter term to cancel the m squared proportional term. Like, how can I cancel it? It is not just a constant; it has.
Oh yeah, no. So you cancel it at one specific point.
Okay.
So you
have some energy scale. Just a given energy scale. So if I change the energy scale, then I can actually see some mass dependence, mass square dependence.
Yeah, but remember, the thing we identify as a physical mass corresponds to the pole and the propagator.
Yes.
So, but yeah, you can also define running masses.
Yeah.
But a running mass typically goes like some loop factor. So the fact that you can't cancel it off at all points means that you're going to get something that looks of this form. So we'll talk a little bit about this later, where the log t over T naught, oh sorry. Okay, so if mu and mu naught are some reference scales, so if mu naught is some reference scale, the value of the running mass at some different scale, mu, is given by the value at mu naught plus a log correction. So this running correction is under control. And the running correction is a thing that's left over after you've canceled off this stuff, but from the residual momentum dependence of the log.
But still, it's not proportional to the Fermi mass squared.
Well, it's proportional to the value at this reference scale.
Oh.
So this is the running value. But so in this case, the natural mu naught is the scalar integrator of the heavy fermion. And the point is that the natural value set by integrating of the heavy fermion is this factor. So okay, but the point is if I arrange within my effective theory for the effective low scale mass at mu naught to be small, it will stay small up to log corrections. So that's under control. But the thing we don't know how to explain is why this thing isn't huge. So that's a naturalist problem. So yes, there is some residual dependence that you can hide in the form of running couplings. But the point is, the problem isn't so much the running as it is the boundary condition. It seems like the natural value for the boundary condition should be really big. Okay. So this is a natural this corresponds to the naturalist problem for scalars. And we see it coming up in effective field theory, even after we've done renormalization. But the problem here is roughly equivalent to the quadratic sensitivity on the cutoff for scalars. Whereas this doesn't apply to fermions. For fermions, because of the chiral protection, at worst I can have log dependences. And log dependences numerically aren't too big. So at this point, I want to change gears and talk about one way to address this, which is supersymmetry. I need to change my sheet of paper. Okay, so the idea of supersymmetry, in a nutshell, is it's a symmetry that relates scalars to fermions. And by relating scalars to fermions, the scalars end up inheriting the chiral protection that fermions have for their masses. So we can see this explicitly. So the way this protection comes up in terms of loops is that suppose I go back to my theory up here. In my theory up here, the thing I'd be integrating out wouldn't just be a fermion. I'd have both a fermion and a fermion superpartner, which would be a scalar. And in this case, my correction to delta m squared would have the form, if I integrated out both the fermion psi and a scalar superpartner, psi tilde, what I would get for my delta m squared would have the form, after renormalizing, of the form something looks like y squared over 4 pi squared m psi squared minus m psi tilde squared. Because this would come from the loop of fermions. And this piece would come from a loop of the new superpartner. And it turns out that supersymmetry enforces that the couplings of the vertex are related. And we'll see how that comes about in a second. And this thing, because it's a fermion loop, has an extra minus sign compared to this. So if you recall, when you take a fermion loop, you trace over the fermion stuff in the middle, and you add an extra minus sign. And that corresponds to just a sign that you get from anti-commuting the Grassmann-valued fermion fields when you do the matrix film. So I get an extra minus sign. And I see that my correction cancels off exactly in the limit that these two things cancel off exactly. But we know that we know that nature isn't exactly supersymmetric in the sense that because supersymmetry predicts for every particle a superpartner with the same couplings to stuff, if supersymmetry were exact, for every electron, we'd have a scalar electron with the same mass and the same couplings. And we definitely don't see that. So we know that supersymmetry can't be exact. But what we can do is arrange for supersymmetry to be approximate in the sense that the mass splittings between fermions and their scalar superpartners aren't too big. So in particular, if I want my delta M squared to apply to the Higgs, and I want this to be kind of less than roughly a TeV scale squared, which is about the maximal correction we can live with for the Higgs, that means that this mass splitting shouldn't be too much larger than a TeV squared. So this motivates having supersymmetry as an approximate symmetry, such that we get a cancellation for the Higgs mass parameter, but where the splitting between particles and the superpartners is not too much bigger than about a TeV.
Psi is a fermion, psi twiddle is the superpartner, so it's a scalar.
Yes.
And then what is that delta m? With which mass does it correspond to the unit correction are we calculating at this point?
So this is the delta m squared for the scalar that I have in mind identifying with the Higgs.
Okay.
So the idea is, suppose I have a scalar field that couples to a particle in the superpartner.
Oh, okay.
This is the correction from the fermion, this is the correction from the scalar superpartner. And then they conspire in such a way such that the coupling to the phi is the same. So that fixes this. And as long as their masses aren't too different, the size of the correction can be small, even if these individual masses are very big. Yes?
Do we expect to see supersymmetry if it exists in the near future in the LHC or the detector?
Yeah, so that's the hope, and I'll get to that. Okay, so anyway, this is a big idea. I want to move next and talk about a few technical things before doing supersymmetry in a bit more detail. So the more technical things and are, first of all, I want to remind you how we identify different types of particles with representations of the Poincaré group. So this should be something you've seen, but it's good to just go over it briefly. For what we want to do with supersymmetry. And the first thing I want to mention is that, and this comes up all over physics, and you've been doing it for a while, and the first idea is the idea of representations of groups. Okay, so you've all seen groups. Groups are essentially just things where you can multiply everything together, and you have an identity element, and an inverse, and everything works out nicely. So a representation of a group, or a linear representation, means that if I'm given a group, my group has a set of group elements. And a linear representation means that for each element of the group, I'll call it, say, G in the group G, there exists a matrix that I'll write M of G that satisfies the group multiplication rule. And what I mean by this, M is a linear operator. Or I can always think of it in a specific basis as a matrix. This linear operator in a representation has to satisfy the group multiplication rule, which means that M of G composed with M of H, and I can think of this as either composing linear operators or as matrix multiplication, has to be equal to the corresponding representation matrix or linear operator corresponding to the group element G times H. And then consistency also requires that M, the identity element of the group, so every group has an identity element, just corresponds to the identity linear operator. Okay, so you've all seen representations. This is them in a nutshell. For any group, there's always a trivial representation. And the trivial representation means that for every group element, I just map it to the identity operator, if you like an identity matrix. Because if I think about identity matrices, they trivially satisfy this, and they trivially satisfy that. So there's no problem at all. But of course, there are more interesting and more complicated representations. If I represent a group on a vector space of dimension D, we say it's a d-dimensional representation. And so on and so forth. So this should all be stuff you've seen. And I just wanted to remind you how it goes. So the next thing we want to deal with is slightly fancy representations, which correspond specifically to representations of groups with an infinite number of elements whose group elements we can parameterize by continuous variables. So very roughly, these correspond to what are called Lie groups. And again, a Lie group just means that for a given group element, we can think of a group element as being parameterized by some continuous set of variables that I'll call alpha, where A is just some index. So and I'll have in mind that alpha A lives in Rn. So it's just some n tuple of real numbers. So the nice thing about Lie groups is, Lie groups come up all over the place. One example is the rotation group. And the other example that we'll see for supersymmetry is the Lorentz group, as well as the Poincaré group. So we're going to be particularly interested in linear representations of Lie groups. And for that, that means that for every group element, we can identify group elements with some set of coordinates. I'll call alpha A. For each set of alpha A that specifies a given group element, we want to find a corresponding linear operator M of alpha. And it turns out that if we choose our coordinates in a nice way, we can choose our coordinates such that the zero point of this Rn space corresponds to the identity element here. And when you do that and choose a nice basis, this means that it turns out that we can write schematically a given group element in the so-called exponential representation. And what I mean by this is this is a formal linear operator, which you should think of as being just a formal expression for the power series expansion. Okay, and this means that if we found to find a set of matrices that represents a given group element, alpha A, this is equivalent to finding a set of so-called generators, TA, that goes into the so-called exponential representation. And this makes our lives easier because we started with an infinite number of group elements. And that means we have an infinite number of linear operators. But to given this so-called exponential representation, to figure out the set of operators, we only need to figure out a finite set of generators TA. So alpha A is an okay. So by A, I mean A runs from 1 to up to N. Okay. And it turns out that these generators, for consistency of the setup, have to satisfy essentially two conditions. The first is a so-called Lie algebra, which these generators satisfy this. So I can think of this FABC as a way to define the group, in fact. So again, this should be familiar from, I don't know, let's say SU2 for spin and quantum mechanics, where these correspond roughly to sigma matrices, and this would be an epsilon IJK. This is just a generalization of that idea to a more general set. And then there's the so-called Jacobi identity, which involves essentially a cyclic set of, again, I'm assuming you've seen all this. So this is my commutation relations. And this is the so-called Jacobi identity, which is just equivalent to the group being associative. OK, so you've seen this stuff before. And you've seen this stuff before in the case of spin. In the case of spin for quantum mechanics, the underlying Lie group is SU2. And the simplest representation for spin is a two-dimensional so-called fundamental representation. The representation matrices correspond to the sigma matrices over 2. You have this with epsilon ijk. They automatically satisfy this. your spin operators, your finite spin operators, you recall, are exponentials of the sigma matrices. And you also saw different representations. So an obvious representation for SU2 is a two-dimensional one, and that corresponds to spin 1/2. But there are other bigger representations for them as well. And these other bigger representations correspond to different spins. So you have the trivial spin, which just corresponds to the trivial representation of the group, where you map every group element to the identity. And that corresponds to just setting the generators to 0, which, again, trivially satisfies this and this. But you also have bigger representations, like spin 1, spin 3/2, and so on, which give you, which you saw in terms of explicit matrices that satisfy these same commutation relations. And the spin operators for them have the same, in this case, let's say J operators or L operators for orbital angular momentum have this form as well, but they're now 3x3 or 4x4 or so on and so forth. So this is all stuff you've seen before. And we're going to apply this to the Lorentz group and the Poincaré, and its extension to the Poincaré group. So let me just figure out how to raise this. OK, so in terms of flat spacetime, our set of symmetries correspond to the Poincaré group. And the Poincaré group is just a combination of Lorentz transformations, which means Lorentz boosts plus spacetime rotations plus spacetime translations. So this is kind of a big, complicated Lie group. But we can define it in terms of a set of commutators. And the set of commutators can be chosen to be p mu and j mu nu. Or sorry, the set of generators can be chosen to be 4 translations. So the 0 component is what you identify with time translation, so generator, which corresponds to the Hamiltonian. The spatial pieces are spatial translations, which are momenta. These j mu nu correspond to Lorentz boosts and spins. So in particular, j0 nu correspond to boosts. And jij correspond to rotations. And specifically, this j mu nu is antisymmetric. Sorry?
Is a boost?
So the J0Is are boosts. The JIJs are rotations. And this is anti-symmetric. And this is an anti-symmetric object with this two-index tensor, which, because it's anti-symmetric, only has 6 independent components that correspond to this. So this has 6 objects within it that represent the 6 generators of 3 boosts, 3 rotations. This gives me the 4 translations. And there's a set of commutation relations for these. OK, so this is 0. This is something that involves p's. And this is something that involves j's. They're written out of my notes, but okay. You get the idea. So we have this Lie algebra structure. And what we want to do to write reasonable theories that are consistent with the Poincaré symmetry is find representations of this group, and specifically representations of this group that are finite dimensional. And we're going to arrange for our fields, the degrees of freedom in our theory, to transform under specific finite dimensional representations of this group. And the reason for this is that linear representations are, relatively speaking, easy. You don't need to use linear representations, but things get very complicated very quickly. So we're going to stick with linear representations. And specifically, we're going to decompose our quantum fields into irreducible representations of this group. OK, so a general Poincaré transformation acting on a vector x maps x to some so it takes x, you do a translation, and you do a Lorentz transformation. So I can put indices on it. So this lambda x as usual, lambda mu nu Lorentz transformation matrix. And in infinitesimal form, you can show that Lorentz transformation matrix corresponds to the first element is the identity, which corresponds to delta mu nu. And then there's an omega mu nu, which is the leading transformation parameter. So for infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, you can always write it as the identity plus a small piece, which if I was to lower the indices on this, you could show that this is anti-symmetric. OK. So what we have now is we want our quantum fields to transform in a well-defined way under Poincaré transformations. And that is specifically a quantum field where this C is going to be some Lorentz index transforms to some exponential of so this is how a field transforming linearly under Poincaré transforms under an arbitrary transformation. So my arbitrary transformation under Poincaré has 10 parameters. I have 6 parameters in this omega mu nu that defines the particular Lorentz transformation I'm doing. And I have 4 parameters in the A mu that defines the translation I'm doing. So the rule for fields is that two things are happening. The first is that the field has a space-time dependence. And if I think about having a blob here, I do this Lorentz transformation, let's say by a translation, and I move the blob from here to here. And to compensate for that, I have to shift the argument of the field. But the other thing is I also have a rotation of the field in the Lorentz space. And the rotation of the field in the Lorentz space is parameterized by, this is like the alpha A I wrote up there. This is the parameter that describes a particular Lorentz transformation group element I'm doing. And this is the matrix that generates, this is the generator of the matrix. So in other words, this is this is like the TA I wrote above, but for a specific representation of the Lorentz group. So I'll come back to specific representations of the Lorentz group, but it turns out that you can specify them completely by essentially 2 spin quantum numbers. OK, so at this point, everything's very formal, but I'll give you some examples that hopefully make this much clearer. I don't know why I'm raising that. Okay. So, but the big point though is that if we can find the set of different ways, the set of different representations of the Lorentz group, we can find the set of different ways different kinds of fields will transform under Lorentz transformations, under Poincaré transformations, and we can use this to classify different field types. And this classification is going to correspond to different kinds of particles, whether they're spin 0, spin 1/2, spin 1, and so on. OK. So the first thing is that the explicit representations of the Lorentz subgroup, which I'm writing this way, can be parameterized by these J1 and J2 numbers, where both Ji, J1 and J2, are either 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, or so on. So they turn out to be half integer. And there's a nice way in which you can rewrite, there's a trick in which you can rewrite the Lorentz part of the Poincaré group, specifically this piece, in terms of a pair of independent SU2s. So you can think of the representations of Lorentz as being a combination of two representations of SU2. And we know what the representations of SU2 are. They're just these half-integer spin objects. And you know how to build them using raising the Lorentz operators, and it's all straightforward.
And they're specific to four dimensions, right?
Yes. Yeah. So OK. So I'm only dealing with four dimensions here. But this set of technology can be expanded to any number of dimensions. But yeah, for now, I just have in mind four dimensions. Where are we? OK, so the trivial representation is J1 equals J2 equals to 0. And that just gives me J mu nu 0, 0 of 0, which if I plug it back in here, I put 0 in here, this matrix just collapses onto a unit matrix. And I don't have any net rotation of the field when I do a Lorentz transformation. And that corresponds to a scalar field. Because if you recall, a scalar field under Poincaré transformations, you change the argument of the field, but you don't do anything else to it. Okay. So that's just about the easiest one. The next one up is, the next two up are J1 equals 1/2. J2 equals to 0, or J2 equals to 0, J1 equals to 1/2. So the 1/2 0 or 0 1/2. And in this case, we know how to build these. Building these corresponds to these Jijs essentially being a sum of sigma matrices. These correspond to so-called left-handed and right-handed two-component fermions. And I'll talk a lot more about these in a minute. And then finally, the next one that we're going to use a fair bit of is the 1/2 1/2. And if you count the number of components for 1/2 1/2, I have 4. And it turns out that this corresponds to just the standard so-called spin equals 1 four-vector rep. And OK, so for the left and right-handed fermions, so I have a scalar field. This corresponds to a psi L and psi R. And this vector representation starts to look like vector field A mu. OK, and then you can keep on going and build bigger representations, but these are the ones we're going to care about.
Do we only care about 1/2 1/2 representation for the vector field? Like what about 1, 0, and 0, 1?
The 1, 0 doesn't actually give you the vector field. It gives you something else. This is the one that's actually relevant for the vector. So this one you can show corresponds to the, if you like, the fundamental representation of Lorentz corresponding to these guys. So these guys actually match up with the 1/2 1/2 representation, which is just how regular four vectors transform. So a regular four vector corresponds to the 1/2 1/2. So that's the one we're going to use. OK, so now there's a slight twist here. And the slight twist is that it turns out to be straightforward to find representations of the Lorentz group. But the harder thing is to find representations of the Lorentz group, or I should say the Poincaré group, that are unitary. So it turns out that if I have a group that is compact, which means that the set of continuous parameters that define it live in a compact space, it's relatively straightforward to find unitary representations. And that's the case for SU2, for example. So for SU2, everything lives in a nice compact space. For the Poincaré group, that's not the case. Because if you think about the Poincaré group, the rotation part is nice and compact, but the boost part isn't. I can think about essentially infinite boosts, or I can think about infinite translations. So in that sense, the Poincaré group is no longer compact. And that means that building representations that are unitary becomes much, much more difficult. And it turns out that when we apply representations to fields, these representations don't have to be unitary at all. And in general, these transformation matrices, these transformation matrices aren't unitary. But when we talk about quantum states, for quantum states, the representations do have to be unitary. And the unitarity corresponds to essentially preserving the symmetry acting on quantum states and operators. So we have an additional requirement beyond fields when we find representations of Poincaré on states. So specifically, a unitary representation is one for which the matrix corresponding to the inverse of a group element is equal to So first of all, for any representation, the matrix corresponding to the inverse of a group element has to correspond to the inverse matrix of the group. So this is just consistency of the multiplication law. A unitary group is one for which the inverse matrix corresponds to its Hermitian conjugate. So that means that the matrices representing the group are a set of unitary matrices. So again, you saw this for spin, and so on and so forth. So this is if I also demand that the representations are unitary, I get extra conditions beyond this. And it turns out that to classify these representations, it's useful to use two quantities. The so-called Casimirs. And the reason it's useful to use these specifically is that you can show that these objects, P squared and W squared, commute with all of these generators. And because these things commute with everything else and they commute with each other, I can simultaneously diagonalize them. And if I have a state that has a given p squared quantum number and w squared quantum number, this won't be changed by acting with any of the other generators.
So what is w?
It's the so-called Pauli-Lubansky pseudovector, which I don't want to. Actually, I guess I have it in my notes. Corresponds to w mu, rho sigma, j nu, rho. P sigma over 2, and then different people have different conventions on twos and signs and so on. So this is a so-called Pauli-Lubansky pseudovector, but it's some combination of angular momentum and momentum combined asymmetrically. Okay, but the important part is that these things commute with everything else. So if I find a representation with fixed quantum numbers for this, it'll be irreducible and it won't be mixed up by anything else. Okay, so the p squared quantum number can be identified with the total mass of the state. So this one, I think, is fairly intuitive. For a given particle, I can go to the rest frame of the particle. And in the rest frame of the particle, this corresponds to just the mass squared of the particle. So this one is sort of intuitive. The less intuitive one, though, is the Pauli-Lubansky pseudovector. And this one depends on whether the possible values here depend on whether the particle is massive or massless. So in the first case, for a massive particle, I have a well-defined notion of a rest frame. And for a massive particle, I can go to the particle rest frame, in which case it turns out that my p mu can just correspond to m 0. And my w squared in this rest frame reduces to, if I have this right, minus m squared j dot j, which just looks like the usual j squared angular momentum invariant that you see in regular quantum mechanical states. And this means that for a particle, a massive particle at rest, I can classify the representations according to the mass and its total angular momentum. And this is something we know how to do. This is the total angular momentum at rest. And we identify this with the spin of the particle. So massive particles behave in the way we expect usual quantum mechanical states to behave. They have a fixed mass. They have a fixed spin. That corresponds to this quantum number. For zero mass, though, life is a little bit more difficult. For zero mass, so this is the massive case. For the massless case, I no longer have a notion of a rest frame. Instead, for the massless case, these correspond to p squared equals to zero. But even with p squared equals to zero, what I can choose is a value of p mu such that I align the momentum along one axis. Now, in this case, you can show that the representations of that are unitary no longer correspond to spin. Instead, you can show that given this, there are essentially two values for the W squared quantum number. And in this case, the W squared quantum number corresponds, in a sense, to plus or minus 1, which I can identify with something called helicity, which means that the things that correspond to this W squared correspond to, if you like, a spin aligned with the direction of motion or a spin anti-aligned with the direction of motion. And this, this sounds a little bit funny, but it applies to a lot of different representations in a way that actually matches up with expectations. So one simple case is massless fermions. So we'll get to massless fermions in a second, but for massless fermions, we have left and right-handed fermions. And in reasonable theory, I always have a left-handed fermion and its corresponding antiparticle, and you can identify those as the two helicity states. So in that case, so let's say I have a left-handed fermion and its antiparticle, that gives me the two helicity states. That's my representation in terms of physical particles. So there, the two make sense. But another case where the two comes up is for photons. So recall that a physical photon only has two polarizations. And the physical photon also falls into this p squared equals to zero class. And these two polarizations correspond to the two helicity states. And it turns out that this applies to objects with quote unquote higher spin. So for example, a graviton. A graviton is quote unquote spin 2, but it's not quite exactly spin 2 in terms of the physical particles. For a graviton, once you get rid of the extra gauge or coordinate variance degrees of freedom, there are actually only two independent polarizations. So for massless particles, this 2 is actually fixed for everything. And there's a important difference between the massless and the massive cases, which again matches up with what you've seen, but this might be presenting it in a slightly different language. Okay. In any case, I'm going to wrap up here. But on Monday, I'll come back and talk about specific representations of two-component fermions. So you've seen a little bit of this before, but it's going to be very important for supersymmetry. So I want to go over it again, mostly to give you a bit more practice, but also because at least for talking about the standard model or field theories in four dimensions, two-component fermions are typically the more natural language to use because they correspond to the irreducible representations of the Lorentz group rather than reducible ones. So we'll come back Monday.